Mr. White's mouth closed. His expression of surprise became one of horror, and then one of shock, and then one of terrible, wonderful bliss. He began to unravel. He came apart like a big and complex jigsaw puzzle made of tiny pieces, crumbling gently at the extremities, and then vanishing into the air. The last piece to evaporate was the lips, and then they too were gone. A half-chewed, chocolate-coated coffee bean dropped onto the street. Lutse reached down quickly, picked up the axe, and flourished it at the other auditors. They leaned back out of the way, mesmerized by authority.
"Who does this belong to now?" he demanded. "Come on, whose is it?"
"It is mine. I am Miss Taupe," shouted the woman in grey.
"I am Mr. Orange, and it belongs to me. No one is even sure that taupe is a proper colour," screamed Mr. Orange.
An auditor in the crowd said, rather more thoughtfully,
"Is it the case, then, that hierarchy is negotiable?"
"Certainly not," Mr. Orange was jumping up and down. "You have to decide it among yourselves," said Lutse.
He tossed the axe into the air. 100 pairs of eyes watched it fall. Mr. Orange got there first, but Miss Taupe trod on his fingers. After that, it became very busy and confusing, and, to judge by the sounds from within the growing scrum, also very, very painful. Lutse took the arm of the astonished Unity.
"How quickly they learn, eh?" he said. "Best to let them sort it out themselves. No one will thank us for interfering."
There was a scream from somewhere in the mob.
"Democracy at work," said Lutse happily.
He glanced up. The flames above the world were dying out, and he wondered who'd won. There was bright blue light ahead and dark red light behind, and it amazed Susan how she could see both kinds without opening her eyes and turning her head. Eyes open or shut, she couldn't see herself. All that told her that she was something else besides mere point of view was a slight pressure on what she remembered as her fingers, and the sound of someone laughing close to her. A voice said, "The sweeper said everyone has to find a teacher and then find their way."
"And?"
said Susan.
"This is my way. It's the way home."
And then, with a noise that was unromantically very similar to the kind Jason would make by putting a wooden ruler on the edge of his desk and twanging it, the journey ended. It might not even have begun. The glass clock was in front of her, full size, glittering. There was no blue glow inside. It was just a clock, entirely transparent and ticking. Susan looked down the length of her arm and up his arm to Lobsang. He let go of her hand.
"We're here," he said.
"With the clock," said Susan. She could feel herself gasping to get her breath back.
"This is only part of the clock," said Lobsang. "The other part.
The bit outside the universe."
"Yes, the clock has many dimensions. Do not be afraid."
"I don't think I have ever been afraid of anything in my life," said Susan, still gulping air.
"Not really afraid. I get angry. I'm getting angry now, in fact.
Are you Lobsang or are you Jeremy?"
"Yes."
"Yes, I walked into that. Are you Lobsang and are you Jeremy?"
"Much closer."
"Yes, I will always remember both of them. But I would prefer you to call me Lobsang. Lobsang has the better memories. I never liked the name Jeremy, even when I was Jeremy."
"You really are both of them?"
"I am everything about them that was worth being, I hope. They were very different, and they were both me. Born just an instant apart, and neither of them was very happy by himself. It makes you wonder if there is anything to astrology after all."
"Oh, there is," said Susan. "Delusion, wishful thinking, and gullibility."
"Don't you ever let go?"
"I haven't yet."
"Why?"
"I suppose because in this world, after everyone panics, there's always got to be someone to tip the wee out of the shoe."
The clock ticked. The pendulum swung, but the hands did not move.
"Interesting," said Lobsang. "You're not a follower of the way of Mrs. Cosmopolite, are you?"
"I don't even know what it is," said Susan.
"Have you got your breath back now?"
"Yes."
"Let's turn around, then."
Personal time moved on again, and a voice behind them said, "Is this yours?" Behind them there were glass steps. At the top of the steps was a man dressed like a history monk, shaven-headed, besandled. The eyes gave away a lot more. A young man who'd been alive for a very long time, Mrs. Ogg had said, and she had been right. He was holding a struggling death of rats by the scruff of his robe.
He's his own, said Susan, as Lobsang bowed.
Then please take him away with you. We cannot have him running around here. Hello, my son.
Lobsang walked towards him, and they embraced, briefly and formally.
Father, said Lobsang, straightening up,
this is Susan. She has been very helpful.
Of course she has, said the monk, smiling at Susan. She is helpfulness personified.
He put the death of rats on the floor and prodded him forward.
Yes, I'm very dependable, said Susan.
And interestingly sarcastic, too, the monk added.
I am Wen. Thank you for joining us, and for helping our son find himself.
Susan looked from the father to the son. The words and the movements were stilted and chilly, but there was a communication going on that she wasn't party to, and it was happening a lot faster than speech.
"Aren't we supposed to be saving the world?" she said. "I don't want to rush anybody, of course."
"There's something I must do first," said Lobsang. "I must meet my mother."
"Have we got time?"
Susan began, and then added,
"We have, haven't we?
All the time in the world."
"Oh, no. Far more time than that," said Wen. "Besides, there's always time to save the world."
Time appeared. Again there was the impression that a figure that was in the air, unfocused, was resolving itself into a million specks of matter that poured together and filled a shape in space, slowly at first, and then someone was there. She was a tall woman, quite young, dark-haired, wearing a long red and black dress. By the look on her face, Susan thought, she had been weeping, but she was smiling now. Wen took Susan by the arm and gently pulled her aside.
"They'll want to talk," he said. "Shall we walk?"
The room vanished. Now there was a garden with peacocks and fountains, and a stone seat upholstered with moss. Lawns unrolled towards woodlands that had the manicured look of an estate that had been maintained for hundreds of years, so that nothing grew here that was not wanted, or in the wrong place. Long-tailed birds, their plumage like living jewels, flashed from treetop to treetop. Deeper in the woods, other birds called. As Susan watched, a kingfisher alighted on the edge of a fountain. It glanced at her and flew away, its wingbeats sounding like the snapping of fans.
"Look," said Susan, "I don't... I'm not... Look, I understand this sort of thing, really. I'm not stupid. My grandfather has a garden where everything is black. But Lobsang built the clock. Well, part of him did. So he's saving the world and destroying it all at once?"
"Family trait," said Wen. "It is what time does at every instant."
He gave Susan the look of a teacher confronted with a keen but stupid pupil.
"Think like this," he said at last. "Think of everything. It's an everyday word, but everything means everything. It's a much bigger word than universe. And everything contains all possible things that can happen at all possible times in all possible worlds. Don't look for complete solutions in any one of them. Sooner or later, everything causes everything else."
"Are you saying one little world is not important, then?" said Susan.
Wen waved a hand, and two glasses of wine appeared on the stone.
"Everything is as important as everything else," he said.
Susan grimaced.
"You know, that's why I've never liked philosophers," she said. "They make it all sound grand and simple, and then you step out into the world that's full of complications. I mean, look around. I bet this garden needs regular weeding, and the fountains have to be unblocked, and the peacocks shed feathers and dig up the lawn. And if they don't do that, then this is just a fake."
"No, everything is real," said Wen. "At least it is as real as anything else. But this is a perfect moment."
He smiled at Susan again.
"Against one perfect moment, the centuries beat in vain."
"I'd prefer a more specific philosophy," said Susan.
She tried the wine. It was perfect.
"Certainly. I expected that you would. I see you cling to logic as a limpet clings to a rock in the storm. Let me see." Defend the small spaces. Don't run with scissors. And remember that there is often an unexpected chocolate, said Wen. He smiled. And never resist a perfect moment.
A breeze made the fountain splash over the sides of their bowls, just for a second. Wen stood up.
And now I believe my wife and son have finished their meeting, he said.
The garden faded. The stone seat melted like mist as soon as Susan got up, although until then it had felt as solid as, well, rock. The wine glass vanished from her hand, leaving only a memory of its pressure on her fingers and the taste lingering in her mouth. Lobsang was standing in front of the clock. Time herself was not visible, but the song that wove through the rooms now had a different tone.
"She's happier," said Lobsang. "She's free now."
Susan looked around. Wen had vanished along with the garden. There was nothing but the endless glass rooms.
"Don't you want to talk to your father?" she said.
"Later. There will be plenty of time," said Lobsang. "I shall see to it." The way he said it, so carefully dropping the words into place, made her turn.
"You're going to take over," she said. "You are time now."
"Yes."
"But you're mostly human."
"So?" Lobsang's smile took after his father. It was the gentle, and to Susan the infuriating smile of a god.
"What in all these rooms?" she demanded. "Do you know?"
"One perfect moment in each one. An oodleplex of oodleplexes."
"I'm not certain there's such a thing as a genuinely perfect moment," said Susan. "Can we go home now?"
Lobsang wrapped the edge of his robe around his fist and smashed it against the glass front panel of the clock. It shattered and dropped to the ground.
"When we get to the other side," he said, "don't stop and don't look back. There will be a lot of flying glass."
"I'll try to dive behind one of the benches," said Susan.
"They probably won't be there."
"Squeak!" The Death of Rats had scurried up the side of the clock and was peering cheerfully over the top.
"What do we do about that?" said Lobsang.
"That looks after itself," said Susan. "I never worry about it."
Lobsang nodded. "Take my hand," he said. She reached out.
With his free hand, Lobsang grasped the pendulum and stopped the clock. A blue-green hole opened in the world. The return journey was a lot swifter, but when the world existed again, she was falling into water. It was brown, muddy, and stank of dead plants. Susan surfaced, fighting against the drag of her skirts, and trod water while she tried to get her bearings. The sun was nailed to the sky, the air was heavy and humid, and a pair of nostrils was watching her from a few feet away. Susan had been brought up to be practical, and that meant swimming lessons. The Querm College for Young Ladies had been very advanced in that respect, and its teachers took the view that a girl who couldn't swim two lengths of the pool with her clothes on wasn't making an effort. To their credit, she'd left knowing four swimming strokes and several life-saving techniques, and was entirely at home in the water. She also knew what to do if you were sharing the same stretch of water with a hippopotamus, which was to find another stretch of water. Hippos only look big and cuddly from a distance. Close up, they just look big. Susan summoned up all the inherited powers of the deathly voice, plus the terrible authority of the schoolroom, and yelled, "Go away!" The creature floundered madly in its effort to turn around, and Susan struck out for the shore. It was an unsure shore, the water becoming land and a tangle of sandbanks, sucking black muck, rotted tree roots and swamp. Insects swirled around, and the cobbles were muddy underfoot, and there was the sound of horsemen in the mist, and ice piled up against dead trees, and Lobsang taking her arm.
"Found you," he said.
"You just shattered history," said Susan. "You broke it." The hippo had come as a shock. She'd never realized one mouth could hold so much bad breath, or be so big and deep.
"I know, I had to. There was no other way. Can you find Lutze? I know death can locate any living thing, and since you..."
All right, I know," said Susan darkly. She held out her hand and concentrated. An image of Lutze's extremely heavy lifetimer appeared and gathered weight.
"He's only a few hundred yards over there," she said, pointing to a frozen drift.
"And I know when he is," said Lobsang. "Only 60,000 years away, so..."
Lutze, when they found him, was looking calmly up at an enormous mammoth.
Under its huge hairy brow, its eyes were squinting with the effort both of seeing him and of getting all three of its brain cells lined up, so that it could decide whether to trample on him or gouge him out of the frost-bound landscape. One brain cell was saying gouge, one was going for trample, but the third had wandered off and was thinking about as much sex as possible. At the far end of its trunk, Lutse was saying,
"So you've never heard of Rule One, then?"
Lobsang stepped out of the air beside him. "We must go, Sweeper." The appearance of Lobsang did not seem to surprise Lutse at all, although he did seem annoyed at the interruption.
"No rush, Wonder Boy," he said. "I've got this perfectly under control."
"Where's the lady?" said Susan.
"Over by that snowdrift,"
said Lutse, indicating with his thumb while still trying to outstare a pair of eyes 5 feet apart.
"When this turned up, she screamed and twisted her ankle. Look, you can see I've made it nervous."
Susan waded into the drift and hauled Unity upright. "Come on, we're leaving," she said brusquely.
"I saw his head cut off," Unity babbled, "and then suddenly we were here."
"Yes, that kind of thing happens," said Susan. Unity stared at her, wild-eyed.
"Life is full of surprises," said Susan.
But the sight of the creature's distress made her hesitate. All right, the thing was one of them, one that was merely wearing, well, at least had started out merely wearing a body as a kind of coat, but now, after all, you could say that about everyone, couldn't you? Susan had even wondered if the human soul without the anchor of her body would end up, eventually, as something like an auditor. Which, to be fair, meant that Unity, who was getting more firmly wrapped in flesh by the minute, was something like a human. And that was a pretty good definition of Lobsang, and, if it came to it, Susan as well. Who knew where humanity began and where it finished?
"Come along," she said. "We've got to stick together, right?"
Like shards of glass spinning through the air, fragments of history drifted and collided and intersected in the dark. There was a lighthouse, though. The valley of Oi Dong held on to the ever-repeating day. In the hall, almost all of the giant cylinders stood silent, all time run out. Some had split. Some had melted. Some had exploded. Some had simply vanished. But one still turned. Big Thunder, the oldest and largest, ground slowly on its basalt bearing, winding time out at one end and back on the other, ensuring, as Wen had decreed, that the perfect day would never end. Rambert Handesides was all alone in the hall, sitting beside the turning stone in the light of a butter lamp and occasionally throwing a handful of grease onto the base. A clink of stone made him peer into the darkness. It was heavy with the smoke of fried rock. There the sound was again, and then the scratch and flare of a match.
"Lutse," he said, "is that you? I hope so, Rambert, but who knows these days?"
Lutse stepped into the light and sat down.
"Keeping you busy, are they?"
Handesides sprang to his feet.
"It's been terrible, Sweeper. Everyone's up at the Mandala Hall. It's worse than the Great Crash. There's bits of history everywhere, and we've lost half the spinners. We'll never be able to put it all—" "Now, now, you look like a man who's had a busy day," said Lutse kindly. "Not got a lot of sleep, eh? Tell you what, I'll take care of this. You go and get a bit of shut-eye, okay?" "We thought you were lost out in the world, and—"
the monk burbled.
"And now I'm back," smiled Lutse, patting him on the shoulder. "There's still that little alcove round the corner where you repair the smaller spinners. And there's still those unofficial bunks for when it's the night shift, and you only need a couple of lads to keep their eye on things."
Handesides nodded, and looked guilty. Lutse wasn't supposed to know about the bunks.
"You get along, then," said Lutse.
He watched the man's retreating back and added quietly,
"And if you wake up, you might turn out to be the luckiest idiot that ever there was. Well, Wonder Boy, what next?"
"We put everything back," said Lobsang, emerging from the shadows.
"You know how long that took us last time?"
"Yes," said Lobsang, looking around the stricken hall and heading towards the podium. "I do. I don't think it'll take me as long." "I wish you sounded more certain," said Susan.
"I'm pretty certain," said Lobsang, running his fingers over the bobbins on the board.
Lutse waved a cautionary hand at Susan. Lobsang's mind was already on the way somewhere else, and now she wondered how large a space it was occupying. His eyes were closed.
"The spinners that are left. Can you move the jumpers?" he said.
"I can show the ladies how to," said Lutse.
"Are there not monks
who know how to do this?" said Unity.
"It would take too long. I am an apprentice to a sweeper. They would run around asking questions," said Lobsang. "You will not."
"He's got a point right enough," said Lutse. "People will start saying, 'What is the meaning of this?' and 'Bick it,' and we'll never get anything done."
Lobsang looked down at the bobbins and then across at Susan.
"Imagine that there is a jigsaw all in pieces, but I am very good at spotting edges and shapes. Very good. And all the pieces are moving, but because they were once linked, they have by their very nature a memory of that link. Their shape is the memory. Once a few are in the right position, the rest will be easier. Oh, and imagine that all the bits are scattered across the whole of eventuality and mixing randomly with pieces from other histories. Can you grasp all that?"
"Yes, I think so."
"Good. Everything I've just said is nonsense. It bears no resemblance to the truth of the matter in any way at all. But it is a lie that you can understand, I think. And then afterwards..."
"You're going to go, aren't you?" said Susan.
It was not a question.
"I will not have enough power to stay," said Lobsang.
"You need power to stay human," said Susan. She hadn't been aware of the rise of her heart, but now it was sinking.
"Yes, even trying to think in a mere four dimensions is a terrible effort. I'm sorry. Even to hold in my mind the concept of something called now is hard. You thought I was mostly human. I'm mostly not," he sighed. "If only I could tell you what everything looks like to me. It's so beautiful."
Lobsang stared into the air above the little wooden bobbins. Things twinkled. There were complex curves and spirals, brilliant against the blackness. It was like looking at a clock in pieces, with every wheel and spring carefully laid out in the dark in front of him. Dismantled, controllable, every part of it understood. But a number of small but important things had gone ping into the corners of a very large room. If you were really good, then you could work out where they'd landed.
"You've only got about a third of the spinners," came the voice of Lutse. "The rest are smashed."
Lobsang couldn't see him. There was only the glittering show before his eyes.
"That is true, but once they were whole," he said. He raised his hands and lowered them on the bobbins.
Susan looked around at the sudden grinding noise and saw row after row of columns rising out of the dust and debris. They stood like lines of soldiers, dust cascading from them.
"Good trick!"
Lutse shouted to Susan's ear above the thunder.
"Feeding time into the spinners themselves. Theoretically possible, but we never managed to do it."
"Do you know what he's actually going to do?" Susan shouted back.
"Yeah, snatch the extra time out of bits of history that are too far ahead and shove it into the bits that have fallen behind."
"Sounds simple."
"Just one problem."
"What?"
"Can't do it. Losses."
Lutse snapped his fingers, trying to explain time dynamics to a non-initiate.
"Friction, divergence, all sorts of stuff. You can't create time on the spinners. You can only move it around."
There was a sudden bright blue glow around Lobsang. It flickered over the board and then snapped across the air to form arcs of light leading to all the procrastinators. It crawled between the carved symbols and clung to them in a thickening layer, like cotton winding on a reel. Lutse looked at the whirling light and the shadow within it, almost lost against the glow.
"At least," he added, "until now."
The spinners wound up to their working speed and then went faster under the lash of the light. It poured across the cavern in a solid, unending stream. Flames licked around the bottom of the nearest cylinder. The base was glowing, and the noise from its stone bearing was joining a rising, cavern-filling scream of stone in distress. Lutse shook his head.
"You, Susan, buckets of water from the wells. You, Miss Unity, you follow her with the grease pails."
"And what are you going to do?" said Susan, grabbing two buckets.
"I'm going to worry like hell, and that's not an easy job, believe me."
Steam built up then, and there was a smell of burning butter. There was no time for anything but to run from the wells to the nearest spitting bearing and back, and there was not enough time even for that. The spinners turned back and forth. There was no need for the jumpers now. The crystal rods that had survived the crash hung uselessly from their hooks as time arced overhead from one procrastinator to another, showing up as red or blue glows in the air.
It was a sight to frighten the knoptus off any trained spinner driver Lutze knew. It looked like a cascade running wild, but there was some control in there, some huge pattern being woven. Bearings squealed, butter bubbled, the bases of some spinners were smoking. But things held. They're being held, Lutze thought. He looked up at the registers. The board slammed back and forth, sending lines of red or blue or bare wood across the wall of the cavern. There was a pall of white smoke around them as their own wooden bearings gently charred. Past and future were streaming through the air. The sweeper could feel them. On the podium, Lobsang was wrapped in the glow. The bobbins were not being moved any more. What was going on now was on some other level, which didn't need the intervention of crude mechanisms. Lion tamer, Lutze thought. He starts off needing chairs and whips, but one day, if he's really good, he can go into the cage and do the show using nothing more than eye and voice. But only if he's really good. And then you'll know if he's really good, because he'll come out of the cage again. He stopped his prowl along the thundering lines because there was a change in the sound. One of the biggest spinners was slowing down. It stopped as Lutze watched, and didn't start again. Lutze raced around the cavern until he found Susan and Unity. Three more spinners stopped before he reached them. "He's doing it! He's doing it! Come away!" he shouted. With a jolt that shook the floor, another spinner stopped. The three ran towards the end of the cavern, where the smaller procrastinators were still whirling. But the halt was already speeding down the rows. Spinner after spinner slammed to a standstill, the domino effect overtaking the humans until, when they reached the little chalk spinners, they were in time to see the last ones rattle gently to a standstill. There was silence, except for the sizzle of grease and the click of cooling rock.
"Is it all over?"
said Unity, wiping the sweat from her face with her dress and leaving a trail of sequins. Lutze and Susan looked at the glow at the other end of the hall, and then at one another.
"I don't think so," said Susan.
Lutze nodded.
"I think it's just..." he began.
Bars of green light leapt from spinner to spinner and hung in the air as rigid as steel. They flickered on and off between the columns, filling the air with thunderclaps. Patterns of switching snapped back and forth across the cavern. The tempo increased. The thunderclaps became one long roll of overpowering sound. The bars brightened, expanded, and then the air was all one brilliant light, which vanished. The sound ceased so abruptly that the silence clanged. The trio got to their feet slowly.
"What was that?"
said Unity.
"I think he made some changes," said Lutze.
The spinners were silent. The air was hot. Smoke and steam filled the roof of the cavern. Then, responding to the routine of humanity's eternal wrestle with time, the spinners began to pick up the load. It came gently like a breeze, and the spinners took the strain from the smallest to the largest, settling once again into their gentle, ponderous pirouette.
"Perfect," said Lutze. "Almost as good as it was, I'll bet."
"Only almost," said Susan, wiping the butter off her face.
"Well, he's partly human," said the sweeper.
They turned to the podium, and it was empty. Susan was not surprised. He'd be weak now, of course. Of course, something like this would take it out of anyone. Of course, he'd need to rest. Of course.
"He's gone," she said flatly.
"Who knows?" said Lutze. "For is it not written, you never know what's going to turn up."
The reassuring rumble of the procrastinators now filled the cave. Lutze could feel the time flows in the air. It was invigorating, like the smell of the sea. "I ought to spend more time down here," he thought.
"He broke history and repaired it," said Susan. "Cause and cure. That makes no sense."
"Not in four dimensions," said Unity. "In 18 it's all perfectly clear." "And now may I suggest you ladies leave by the back way," said Lutze. "People are going to come running down here in a minute, and it's all going to get very excitable. Probably best if you aren't around."
"What will you do?" said Susan.
"Lie," said Lutze happily. "It's amazing how often that works."
Ick!
Susan and Unity stepped out of a door in the rock that led through rhododendron groves to the path out of the valley. The sun was touching the horizon, and the air was warm, although there were snowfields quite close by. At the lip of the valley, the water from the stream plunged over a cliff in a fall so long that it landed as a sort of rain. Susan pulled herself onto a rock and settled down to wait.
"It is a long way to Ankh-Morpork," said Unity.
"We'll have a lift," said Susan. The first stars were already coming out.
"The stars are very pretty," said Unity.
"Do you really think so?"
"I am learning to. Humans believe they are."
"The thing is, I mean, there's times when you look at the universe and you think, 'What about me?' And you can just hear the universe replying, 'Well, what about you?'" Unity appeared to consider this.
"Well, what about you?" she said.
Susan sighed.
"Exactly,"
she sighed again. "You can't think about just one person while you're saving the world. You have to be a cold, calculating bastard."
"That sounded as if you were quoting somebody," said Unity. "Who said that?"
"Some total idiot," said Susan. She tried to think of other things and added, "We didn't get all of them. There's still auditors down there somewhere."
"That will not matter," said Unity calmly. "Look at the sun."
"Well?"
"It is setting."
"And?"
"That means time is flowing through the world. The body exacts its toll, Susan. Soon my former colleagues, bewildered and fleeing, will become tired. They will have to sleep."
"I follow you, but—"
"I am insane, I know this. But the first time it happened to me, I found such horror that I cannot express it. Can you imagine what it is like? For an intellect a billion years old, in a body which is an ape on the back of a rat that grew out of a lizard? Can you imagine what comes out of the dark places, uncontrolled?"
"What are you telling me?"
"They will die in their dreams."
Susan thought about this. Millions and millions of years of thinking precise, logical thoughts. And then humanity's murky past drops all its terrors on you in one go. She could almost feel sorry for them. Almost. "But you didn't," she said.
"No, I think I must be different. It is a terrible thing to be different, Susan. Did you have romantic hopes in connection with the boy?"
The question came out of nowhere, and there was no defence. Unity's face showed nothing but a kind of nervous concern. "No," said Susan. Unfortunately, Unity did not seem to have mastered some of the subtleties of human conversation, such as when a tone of voice means, "Stop this line of inquiry right now, or may huge rats eat you by day and by night."
"I confess to strange feelings regarding his self that was the clockmaker. Sometimes, when he smiled, he was normal. I wanted to help him, because he seemed so closed in and sad."
"You don't have to confess to things like that," Susan snapped. "How do you even know the word romantic anyway?" she added.
"I found some books of poetry."
Unity actually looked embarrassed. "Really? I've never trusted it," said Susan. "Huge, giant, hungry rats."
"I found it most curious. How can words on a page have a power like that? There is no doubt that being human is incredibly difficult and cannot be mastered in one lifetime," said Unity sadly.
Susan felt a stab of guilt. It wasn't Unity's fault, after all. People learn things as they grow up, things that never get written down, and Unity had never grown up. "What are you going to do now?" she said.
"I do not know. I have some skills by human standards."
"Well, if I can help in any way." It was, she realized later, one of those phrases like, "How are you?" People were supposed to understand that it wasn't a real question, but Unity hadn't learned that either.
"Thank you. You can indeed help."
Fine, if—"
"I wish to die."
And galloping out of the sunset, some riders were approaching. Tick! Small fires burned in the rubble, brightening the night. Most of the houses had been completely destroyed, although, Soto considered, the word "shredded" was much more accurate. He was sitting by the side of the street, watching carefully with his begging bowl in front of him. There were, of course, far more interesting and complex ways for a history monk to avoid being noticed, but he'd adopted the begging bowl method ever since Lutse had shown him that people never see anyone who wants them to give him money. He'd watched the rescuers drag the bodies out of the house, Initially, they'd thought that one of them had been hideously mutilated in the explosion, until it had sat up and explained that it was an Igor, and in very good shape for an Igor at that. The other he'd recognised as Dr. Hopkins at the Guild of Clockmakers, who was miraculously unharmed. Soto did not believe in miracles, however. He was also suspicious about the fact that the ruined house was full of oranges, that Dr. Hopkins was babbling about getting sunlight out of them, and that his sparkling little abacus was telling him that something enormous had happened. He decided to make a report and see what the boys at Oi Dong said. Soto picked up the bowl and set off through the network of alleys back to his base. He didn't bother much about concealment now. Lutsei's time in the city had been a process of accelerated education for many citizens of the lurking variety. The people of Ankh Morpork knew all about Rule One. At least they had known until now. Three figures lurched out of the dark, and one of them swung a length of wood, which would have connected with Soto's head if he hadn't ducked. He was used to this sort of thing, of course. There was always the occasional slow learner, but they presented no peril that a neat slice couldn't handle. He straightened up, ready to ease his way out of there, and a thick lock of black hair fell onto his shoulder, slithered down his robe and flopped onto the ground. It made barely a sound, but the expression on his face as Soto looked down and then up at his attackers made them draw back. He could see, through the blood-red rage, that they all wore stained grey clothes and looked even crazier than the usual alley people. They looked like accountants gone mad. One of them reached out towards the begging bowl. Everyone has a conditional clause in their life, some little unspoken additional to the rules like, except when I really need to, or unless no one is looking, or indeed, unless the first one was a nougar. Soto had for centuries embraced a belief in the sanctity of all life and the ultimate uselessness of violence. But his personal conditional clause was, but not the hair. No one touches the hair, okay? Even so, everyone ought to have a chance. The attackers recoiled as he threw the bowl against the wall, where the hidden blades bedded themselves in the woodwork. Then it began to tick. Soto ran back down the alley, skidded around the corner, and then shouted, "Duck!" Unfortunately for the auditors, alas, he was just a tiny, tiny fraction of a second too late. Tick! We'll be right back.